Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode. And today I am joined by Alison Rochelle. Welcome.
Thank you, Kate.
Now, Alison is a former police sergeant, as it happens. And Alison is also actually doing my training program as well. So we'll talk about that at the end. But you left the force, didn't you, because of trauma, PTSD, and also you were going through domestic abuse yourself, which was disclosed through a counselling session.
So yes, wasn't aware of it.
Yeah. So what's your experience with domestic abuse in the force?
Oh, as I said, it's really interesting because I look back, like I was only young, like I was 19 when I joined the police. So I guess I wouldn't say I was uneducated because I did really well at school, but there was nothing really spoken about relationships. So I jumped into the police, and one of our biggest jobs we were always going to was domestic violence matters. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, everything we used to do, and I was in New South Wales for this time and worked at different places across New South Wales, but it's still very much the same, that it didn't matter where we went to. We either went to an incident where someone had physically been harmed, so it might have been sexually assaulted, it might have been physically abused, a lot of blood, or we went to arguments. And like I look back now, and it's probably why I didn't realise that I was in an abusive relationship and actually had grown up in, I guess, not your physical abusive household, but there was a lot of, I guess, emotional, psychological abuse. Because in the police, it was either an assault, like you had an actual name for it, but everything else that involved just words being exchanged or threats was always dismissed as a domestic violence, no offence. So there was this whole concept that yelling at someone, threatening someone, abusing them, calling them names wasn't an offence. But now it's like, hang on, these are really important issues that had been missed for so long. Because this all leads up to something, and it's usually the name calling, it's usually the threats, it's usually the loud voices, the yelling that build up to that physical abuse. But we were missing all these early signs, and then people wouldn't leave. And it's like, well, you've got flogged or you've been abused. Why won't you leave? Because we didn't have that education and awareness to go, well, hang on, there is something different. We could do something different. It was, oh, yeah, we were, can refer you to an organisation, you'd get referred. But it was like nothing got followed up, and so much seemed to just be dismissed or downplayed. So I look back and go, well, how much difference could I have made between like 1999, 2014 when I was in the police if I had the awareness and knowledge now back then? And I guess that's where it's given me this passion now. And even in the last few weeks, I've really reshifted from where I was focusing on to really bring that education and awareness into it. Because if we don't have the education or awareness, we don't know.
No, and that's exactly it. And it isn't, you know, having we spoke about this before we started recording, it isn't the police's fault. You know, they are, you know, it's leadership's fault for not providing this training, the appropriate training for their officers, you know, that are on the ground. But what is the officer's fault is how they respond when their gap in knowledge is highlighted to them. You know, they have to be open to listening and learning. You know, it's, you know, even at the level that I'm trained at in both trauma and abuse related crimes, you're always learning. In this space, you are always learning. You know, and, you know, particularly when new laws do come in, you have to make it your business to really understand that new law. So, of course, it is new in Queensland and New South Wales, coercive control. which means there has to be a lot more emphasis put on it. But you know, it isn't, it's very silent coercive control a lot of the time. You know, and we spoke about this before. Again, they perform, you know, they perform well outside of the home. A lot of it's hidden. The victim performs well outside of the home. She puts on a performance. She's conditioned to it, and in some ways, as a victim, we start to believe our own performance. That's how
Definitely.
well we perform it. It's a default mechanism. It's like it's the minute we step out that door, that's it, the mask's on. We perform it well.
Definitely.
Yeah, Annie, I mean, you'll probably find as well that you when you were in the police, that they may report, they may reach out for help, but then the minute they're sat in front of an officer, they're downplaying their own experience that they've reached out for help for, because it's a default mechanism.
Definitely. And that's like when you talk about the training, like I look back and it's like police are generalized. We're general duty. So we're expected to know everything for whatever state we're in. We're not given specific training. And even though I had specific training, like I had child protection background and did that for a number of years and was with the sex crime squad, we had some training that was specialized, but even as child protection, to deal with everything that was child protection, from a neglect to an assault to whatever involved a child. And same with sex crimes, there's a whole heap of variation. So we're not actually given, I guess, that intensive training to understand. And usually training is you join the academy or you might do a 12-month course, but there's no real follow-up, there's no real education. And as you say, unless you're, I guess, a go-getter yourself and going to actually be up to date and want to research the law and really understand it, which I very much was, and I still am. I like to really understand what are all the elements of the offence, how can we prove it, what's needed to understand what's happening. You're left in the dark and you're trying to juggle everything. And in Queensland, this is one thing that I found really interesting, was like general duties police would come to an incident or something that happened. They didn't actually make a decision. They had to ring the sergeant back at the station for them to make a decision. And then someone else had to make a decision. And it was like, hang on. We've got people investigating who are seeing what's happened, not able to make a decision, to go into someone who's not here making a decision, and then saying that it's easier to charge someone with a domestic violence offence or take action, because if they don't do anything, they've got to justify it to the sergeant, another sergeant, another sergeant, another sergeant. But there are still so many examples where nothing is still done. So how is it actually easier to charge someone when most people you talk to have got no results, no action, no one being charged? And like even my own matter, out of probably 20, 30 odd breaches, including where he'd admitted it in statements, nothing was done because the affidavits didn't mean anything. This didn't mean anything. There wasn't enough charges to justify stalking. So you admit to me it's easier to charge him and put it before a court, but here you tell me it's not. So even the police are telling us conflicting stories. And I guess I was able to see that for what it was and go, well, all right, so you're gaslighting me myself to try and get me out of your station, because I was determined. I spent 3 hours there asking why they wouldn't do anything and why they were calling me vexatious for continuing to report these breaches, because everyone had said, report it, report it, report it. And my first comment was, I'm reporting this breach so it's on record. I know you're not going to do anything because you haven't done anything this time, this time, this time, this time. And I'd get the shits with you. And it's like, well, if I don't report it, how does anyone know it's happened?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And actually, you know, stalking, as you know, is probably one, and I say probably, one of the easiest crimes to get over the line, provided people understand stalking, the stalking, what constitutes a stalking. But stalking is anything that's not wanted behavior, and if it continues, and it's called it, and they're doing it to cause the other person distress or impact their life in some way, that constitutes as a stalking offence. And so it is one of the easiest ones to get over the line, provided the professionals understand what constitutes as stalking. And when they
And as I said, I was shut down. I was shut down. Oh no, we can't do this because we've only charged him with two breaches. And if charging with two breaches, but we've got 15 other incidents,
Yeah.
which he's admitted or whatever else, and it's still not enough for stalking. It's like, well, what is? Oh,
Yeah.
well, we need to keep charging him for more offences beforehand. And I'm like, so it's not going to end. So I live in fear. My kids live in fear. I've got CCTV everywhere on my property. You're now telling me to put it inside as well because you don't believe what I'm saying. And because he won't admit it, it's not enough.
And it says something when they are gaslighting one of their own, essentially.
And I was very upfront with them. I was like, I've been where you are. I understand the law. I understand what's required. I know what you need to put together. Oh, no, this has got to go to a high level and it's got to do this and it's got to do this. And it was just like, so in the end, like, I wasn't going to win an argument with them. They
No.
were like, oh, yeah, we can do it, but we can't guarantee. And it's like, well, let's draw the line in the sand now. He's got all his property back. There is no reason for him to contact. There's no reason for the false complaints. If it happens from him, that line in the sand is drawn, and I will hold you police accountable to take action.
Yeah.
Thankfully, it did stop after that, but they really had to step up their game and force him to take property because he didn't want to. He wanted to continue having to have something to do with me. So I was lucky they could see that as well. And they were like, no, take it now or it's gone.
Yeah.
But that was, as I said, hours of fighting. That was police at my house for 5 days for property to be collected, 6 months after he had left,
Yeah. Yeah.
because they wouldn't help 6 months earlier.
And like you say, that that is the reason why they, they do delay collecting things. It's always a reason. It's always a reason to maintain communication, whether it be a house sale or whether it be the children's proceedings. It's always and delaying and not engaging with court proceedings. It's always a way of maintaining that communication. And pulling the victim's strings,
Yep.
because even if
Keeping in his
they're,
space.
yeah, because even if they're
Keeping
not
him, keeping them on
directly,
focus.
100%, because even if they're not directly engaging with you, they know from afar they're impacting you emotionally, and they're satisfied with that, just knowing that I know you're getting bent out of shape here. I know you're seriously impacted by my actions from afar. I'm happy with that, and that's why they engage in system abuse.
Yep. And it's like dragging out court. Like he admitted to the offence to police in October. It's still not finalised in the court system. Like, what are we, July? He admitted it back in October that he was doing this, but hasn't pled guilty, hasn't gone for hearing because he knows he wants to keep seeing me.
Yeah.
He wants to keep dragging it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the court allows it, though.
Of course they do. Yeah, of course they do. Well, they enable it. They enable the abuse, and they prolong the abuse. And that is something I don't agree with. I mean, it's like when a child is forced to see an abusive parent, and the mother is expected to speak highly of the other parent, even though the child witnessed all these things. That is teaching a child that that behavior is okay, and that's what the
But it's
court.
also, yeah, teaching the child not to speak up. Oh, sorry, we know you saw that this happened, but don't speak about it. We've got to talk really nicely about it. Yeah. And it's no wonder patterns get repeated.
Exactly that. Exactly. It's normalizing the behavior with the children, and that's where they're just gonna either repeat the cycle themselves and become the perpetrator, or they will become the victim, and stay silent because that's what they've been taught throughout their life, that this is all normal behavior. It is a huge problem. Huge problem. So we're just going to break for a short interval, and we shall see you after the break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena-sensitive care pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena-sensitive care pads with the skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So just want to share a little bit about your personal experience. Now, obviously, I know you've touched on a little bit with your engagement with the police, which was the same as what it would be if you were when you were working in the police. what's your personal story with your ex?
So I guess my personal story, it started long before I was even aware of it. Like, if I look back, there was a lot of abuse growing up as a child, and there's still some coercive control going on, more not from parents but from a sibling, and isolating from parents, which has all been highlighted now. And like, as much as and as hard it is, and there's a lot of elder abuse that's now coming from that, I've really had to draw the line because I can't help, I can't keep going in that. And then I guess that's where it led into obviously my relationship with my children's dad. And yes, I look back, there was some physical stuff, there was a lot of sexual stuff, which I didn't realise even in 2014 when I'd made the disclosure doing a program to counsellors that he was telling me every night it was his married right to be able to have sex with me.
Yeah.
And admitted it afterwards. But again, he was dismissed and blamed, going, well, I don't know what I'm doing because I was asleep. It's my PTSD. But there was so much dismissive actions around the accountability of what he was doing. And that's where a lot of the physical stuff happened, the sexual stuff happened, so much so that like, he moved out of the bedroom because he didn't want to hurt me, didn't want to hurt kids, but then wouldn't admit it. But that was, I guess, that was a minor part of what was going on. But a lot of it was very much that psychological, the emotional, the isolation, the control sort of tactics, which I look back now, I can really see it. And I know we, in the relationship, I used to be, hold it together. I was the one who was there solving the problems, making sure we had everything, looking forward, putting things together. So I probably kept it together most of the times. But then I'd be pushed and pushed and pushed and not really realizing it at the time. Then I'd react, snap, yell, scream, go, enough's enough, get out of the house, whatever, because I was over it and couldn't control it anymore. Then I would come back to normal. And I've since learned that was very much a reaction to the abuse and holding it together. So I don't look at myself so harshly now, knowing that I was reacting to a situation that I wasn't aware of and couldn't put words to at the time, because I was, like, I can remember the perfect example. Like, we're standing in the kitchen. This was around separation. It was like, I really love what you're doing. You're so passionate about helping others and doing all these things to make family better, but you're not putting our family first. You're not prioritising our family. You're causing the ship to sink. So on one hand, I'd be boosted up, and on the other, I'd be absolutely crushed.
Yeah.
And this happened all the time. It was even like on his birthday, he went out and told a friend of mine that he had feelings for her. And I found this out later, but then came home and gave me a big kiss and was like, I'm really sorry. And I'm like, hang on, there's been no affection for how long? I knew you were having an affair with this person because it was quite obvious. Like, everyone knew it. I'd pulled her up on it. I'd pulled her up on it. Her own daughter was calling you dad in front of our kids. Like, it's an obvious sign that something's going on. Oh, no, there's nothing going on. So questioning him about this, oh, no, I didn't mean it. He would avoid it. That I had to really put my foot down and go, look, this isn't enough. So try to, again, being the problem solver, going, all right, I'll be separating properly, because we had separated in 2017, when I found out he was having a number of emotional affairs with women just before our youngest was born, and he refused to move out. So I ended up going into state with the kids for 3 months to give a space. So knowing that he was the very much the avoidant, wouldn't solve problems, I was trying to go, well, do you want some space to think about what you're doing? Why don't you take the caravan to a caravan park? Let's get Airbnb. We've got timeshare, go and use the timeshare. He didn't like my ideas, and it was later turned around to be my fault that I wouldn't let him see the kids because I wouldn't let him take a caravan. He ended up moving in with his girlfriend, but denied it. Oh no, I'm living with my mate who was his support worker. So he was back and forwards between the two. But again, it was all my fault that I didn't allow this, I didn't allow this. I said, hang on, I gave you everything you wanted. I tried to give you what you needed. I helped you with your budget. I helped with your finance. I tried to give it so you could see the kids when you wanted. Even offered you to come back into the home to have the kids so they had the stability, until I was actually told, hang on, that's really not healthy, because I had no boundary. I mean, I had no safe space. So I had to draw the line on that. And when I stopped that, that's when contact with the kids ceased, pretty much, because there was no safe space for the kids. He had living in a 2-3 bedroom house with her two kids, and then wanting three of our own. And then later went on to, well, we don't know if he actually bought the house with her or not, but a house was bought that was 2 bedroom. So there's them as a couple, her two kids, a boy and a girl, plus our three kids. So they converted into a 3 bedroom house, but I should have been sending my kids to stay there. And it's like, well, where do they sleep? Oh, they can sleep in the lounge room. It's like, you've got three kids, and the youngest was only fairly young, but there was, what is it? There's about 8 years between our youngest and eldest, and there's a girl in the middle. Like, there wasn't even room for them to sleep and share bedrooms. There was no beds. And I was like, hang on, at least provide your kids their own bedroom with at least 2 to 3 beds. Like, the youngest was only little, so he was still sharing at that stage and needed that comfort. But it just continued, and it still continues, like the financial abuse, not wanting to pay child support, but happy to support another pet family and her kids and go on holidays. But I've got no money, so I want an exemption from child support. So instead of paying $5,000 a year for three kids, he was able to get it reduced to 500. And I had no options to appeal it. It was like, sorry, he's given us this. But for me to get any payment, I had to give all my bank details. I had to justify everything as to why I wanted money. But he's able to say, oh, I can't afford it. Even though you could prove that he was going on holidays, he was living the best life ever. If he had no income, how did he run a car? How did he run a boat? How did he go on holidays? How did he do all these things? Oh no, she supported him. So again, the system was allowing it to happen.
And as you know, from a police perspective and from an investigation perspective, when there's an investigation of coercive control, these are things that should be taken into consideration, because it highlights, okay, they can't convict somebody for not paying child support. But when they can see that actually, well, you can pay for X, Y, and Z, but you can't support your own children, that highlights there's an element of financial control here. There's financial abuse. And then it helps paint that picture. It helps highlight that pattern that's taking place. And this is what they need to be doing all of the time.
They don't look at the pattern. They don't look at the pictures. Like, I wasn't allowed to see family. He made it so uncomfortable for family events. He'd go and sleep on the lounge and be antisocial. I know we can't go see them this week. Like, I was the one that kept in contact with his family and did most of the trying to keep in contact with them. I very rarely had friends. Or if I did have something with a friend, the friend would be bagged out. Why are you going out again? Why are you trying to do this? So anything I tried to do for myself was always criticized, and I was made to feel guilty. But I didn't realize a lot of this was going on. Or it was like, oh, I'm doing this. And like, we were doing quite well. Like, we'd both been in the police at the time. So whatever we wanted, I was always going, well, buy it for yourself. Like, do what you need. Go out with friends. I was always encouraging him to have this friendship, this relationship. But even interest I had, I wasn't allowed to do it. It's like, no, I'm not going to do that with you. So it had nothing to do with us being a couple. Even the kids, celebrate kids' Christmas or birthdays, because he didn't believe in it. And I said, these are our kids. They've got that love. They want to be able to give gifts. They want to be able to receive it. So even those things were such a struggle that our kids were missing out because he didn't want to do it. It didn't bother him. His computer games, his online network with his friends was the priority.
So he was in the police as well.
Yes, so we both met in the police.
And you see, this is why being in the police, a history of being in the forces, is a risk factor in itself, because they're trained manipulators. You're trained to manipulate. You're trained to coerce in a way.
But it's more than that. You're trying to know the law inside and out and what is required.
And you're trained also to gain compliance.
Yep.
So, and that's why it is a risk factor. And they know how to work within the law. They know what they can get away with and what they can't get away with. And this is why they have to work harder to gain that evidence, to sh demonstrate that pattern when you are dealing with somebody like that, because they're not daft. They know they can't make any mistakes.
They know how to cover. They know how to cover their ass because that's what we're told to do in the police. Cover your ass and make sure you've crossed all your I's, dotted all your T's. So again, I even did that in my personal life afterwards, and I really took it harshly that I was always trying to justify myself. I was always trying to explain why A, B, and C added up. I was always trying to, and everyone goes, "But why are you doing this?" Because that's how I was trained, and letting go of that, I don't need to analyze everything. I don't need to evidence everything. And like I look back now, like I was needing to do it to keep myself and kids safe at the time. But it was so hard trying to live a life and justify it and go, have I covered this and this to show these patterns happening? And I still do it to a degree and keeping that evidence because a lot of the time no one was believing me. So I needed to be able to go, here is. And even then, when you present it all, it still wasn't believed.
Do you think because he did have a police background, do you think that went in his favour when you were reporting?
I don't know. I think it could have, but I think it was just a lot of ignorance by the police because it didn't fit the traditional patterns of what was happening. And at this time, coercive control wasn't an offence in Queensland. So it's like, oh, it's just financial abuse. We can't do anything about it. Oh, it's just this. We can't do anything about it. It's not enough. It's not enough. It's not enough. But then when he complained about financial abuse, they were on my door questioning me about it. And I'm like, hang on. So the application for the protection order had been dropped because my witness is in ICU and I was in a bad mental health space and not willing to risk my mental health for it, which is why we agreed to the undertaking. So as soon as this happens and he's no longer got an order preventing him and controlling his behaviour to protect us, false complaints start about financial abuse. It's like, here's the bank account. It's once assigned. He's got access. Here's this, here's this, here's this. But they were still investigating, interrogating me over what he said. But when I showed them what was happening, there was no investigation. It's like, how is this fair?
Exactly. And that'll be because he was showing up calm, cool, and collected. And whereas you would have been more emotionally charged, and
Especially when you've just been threatened or something, or you've got emails going, if you're going to withhold a child and he's wanting firearms in the same conversation, it's like, well, are you now threatening, you want your firearms? And the child doesn't want to go. What am I thinking? You're going to harm the child. You're going to harm me. And we had firearms involved. He's a trained police officer.
And
So
that
we
back
don't,
is
but
another
he's
risk
also
factor.
trained with firearms for long distance shooting. Like, I know how far he can shoot. And you
That's
tell me it's not a risk.
yeah, well, that is another that's a very, very clear, obvious risk, a risk factor.
And even now, the firearms are still the priority. Like, I've been threatened that I'm financially abusing him because I wouldn't allow him to have firearms that he agreed to surrender. So he agreed to do things and doesn't do it. And it's now on me going, no, you're controlling him. You're financially abusing him. You're penalising him for it. And so, hang on, this is a safety factor. It's got nothing to do with whether or not he should or shouldn't have firearms. He's made threats to harm us. He's turns up at the property unannounced, uninvited. Yet it's all on me that he shouldn't have them and I'm penalizing him now. Well, if that was the case, why did he agree to it? He's agreed to it on a court document with his solicitor as advice.
For me, obviously I've not seen, your timeline or anything, but it is there's risk factors all over the place here. And the biggest one being is the firearms. It can't be ignored. He's trying, like you say,
And because
he's trained to kill. He's trained to kill. That makes him even more dangerous.
and he did a lot of shooting. Like we were together. Like I know how far he can shoot, and I know how good a shot he is with him because we were doing a lot of vermin control for farms. So you're not shooting close proximity distance, and these are headshots he can make. And even then, when he didn't have his firearms, it's like, well, I'll bypass what's there. I'll just apply for new ones. So it was like, how can I manipulate the system? I won't see my kids because of this undertaking, and you're going to be there. But it's okay. I'm just going to go get more firearms. Like, so again, using the systems for his own gain to get what he wants.
We're just going to break for another interval, and we shall see you after the break.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list? Then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato. Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
The station that makes you feel good.
So before we finished for the we broke for the break, we were obviously highlighting how lessons aren't ever learned, and the only way that they are going to learn is to learn from past cases where mistakes have been made. Because they all leave clues, all of them leave clues. And I mentioned at the start, Alison is currently doing my training at the moment, which obviously covers, there's a lot of case studies. I know you're not at that stage yet, but there's a lot of case studies. And the reason there is because they all leave clues. The tactics may show up slightly different. Because like as we know, it's not black and white, unfortunately. There's so many moving parts, and we can and obviously you probably if you've read the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Handbook that I wrote for victims, for the average person, I've given examples of certain tactics, but you can't possibly give every single possible scenario because it can play out in so many different ways, and this is where it does require you to use your common sense and read between the lines. Because it's just, it isn't black and white, it never will be black and white. So what are you wanting to do moving forward? Because I know you don't want to, you won't go back into the police.
No. Oh no. If we're asked, will you go back? And it's like, no, because I can't make an impact in the police. I can't do anything in the police because you're so tied by rules and regulations.
Well, it's rules and regulations, but even now that the law is in place, it is a inability to be flexible and learn and be adaptable and be curious, and there aren't many like you, unfortunately. And it's ones like you that are willing to learn, that are curious. And there's power in, not that I say it's good what we went through, it's not, but that makes us good at what we do. It does. Because it's only when you've walked that path can you put yourself into the victim's shoes. You still have to have an element of detachment and impartiality, because it's, again, we can fall prey to instantly believe we and you've got to believe a victim initially until they prove otherwise. And this is where it requires you to be good at looking at the facts and reading between the lines to identify if a victim, if a alleged victim, isn't telling the whole truth. I've walked away from cases before today because as things have unfolded, it's like it isn't quite how you're saying now. I'm now seeing that. That's not to say what he's done to you is right. It's absolutely not right. However, now I can see what part you have played in it. It's the same with a victim that's engaged in reactive abuse. We have to look at why have they responded in that way.
And I guess that's why, like, recently I've stepped up. Like, as I said, I'm doing your course, which I'm absolutely loving because it's tying everything together. But I also really recently did the Lens Behavior Program. So it's taking what I know to the next level as well. So it's not just how they're presenting physically, what they're saying, but I now understand their body language, their microfacial expressions. So they can be the best actor they want and tell me the most convincing story. But in 1/25th of a second, I'm going to be able to see that they're uncomfortable, they're showing contempt, they're lying, they're hiding stuff. And I don't necessarily need to call them out on that at that point, but it's going to give me avenues to open questions to be able to change it. So being able to use your course, the behavior analysis, body language, word analysis, putting all the skills together and the qualifications is really going to help highlight who the actual victim is. And unfortunately, many are trying to be the victim because they've got ulterior motives. Like, I know a friend I was speaking to recently had multiple false allegations made against him because he was a sponsor for a woman and children. So the only way she could get out of a sponsorship was by making these false allegations. They were so far-fetched, but it didn't stop the fact the police had to investigate because a female had made them. So really being able to knuckle down and go, all right, well, and yes, I completely get what you're saying. We do need to believe victims and not dismiss them because so many people quite often dismiss them so quickly because of the way they're presenting or what they're saying. But it's looking at that whole picture. And once you start to see some inconsistencies, then start questioning it more rather than coming in with, you can't be a victim because this is what you're saying or this is what you're doing. It's looking at it and going, well, is there trauma behind it? Is that why they're responding? Is that why they're dismissing this behavior? Is that why they've now gone, I want to report it, but they've retracted it? Because they're living in fear, they've had threats made. So being able to see that and recognize it is going to make a huge difference. And again, it's only going to be through education and awareness and getting more people informed about what's going on to help victims and be able to liaise with police, with support organizations and everyone in this space. Are we going to be able to get that change? Because at the moment, it's like a competition. Who can have the biggest voice? Who's going to get the most sponsorship? Who's going to help who? It's not, let's all get together because we've all got different skills. We've all got different resources. We've got all different knowledge. If we can provide all our charities, our not-for-profits, our government organisations, worked closely with the police, had a unified system, we probably would actually see some changes in this space. But at the moment, it's this organisation, everyone's arguing and trying to get their own change in rather than going, all right, we need to like Hannah's Law bringing coercive control was brilliant. But would it have come forward quicker if we had multiple organisations all getting together to show these are the patterns, this is what's going on, to be able to make that change rather than just one organisation starting from one incident? And there's plenty of people, like, it's not just the Hannah Clark story that's got the change. There's plenty of others that have had an incident happen and have had to start advocating and change. Let's partner together rather than going, no, I'm going to stand alone here, I'm going to stand alone here. And we've got so much of that, it's not. And the DV space is so big that we need to pool our resources, we need to pool the funding so we can actually get the change that's needed.
It's collaboration. Yeah, professionals need to learn to collaborate. You know, there's no shame in, we can't all know everything, you know, we can't. You know, there's elements that I don't know about family court. There's elements that I don't know about the law. You know, section this and section that. I wouldn't know that. I wouldn't know that. But when it comes to risk evaluation, I'm bloody good at it. So, you know, you have to lean towards your strengths. And if you need help from somebody else, ask for it. And, you know, and if they offer it, accept it. You know, particularly when you are offering, you are supporting a victim. And I know that's what you're wanting to do moving forward, isn't it? You know, we support victims directly.
Very much so. And that's what you say with this collaboration. Like, at the moment, there's six of us that are actually coming together. And instead of having to be generalised and try to know a little bit of everything, we're all able to bring our individual skills together. Mm. So we've now got seven people that are covering seven different topics, very dynamic and diverse, which is now going to actually be able to provide a platform across Australia to help with the education, help with the awareness, help with the advocacy, help with the court, because we're all bringing our lived experience, our qualifications in together, rather than me trying to be one person, which I know I couldn't. And that's, like, I started obviously this by myself, but I knew I needed to connect with others, which is why I said I'd connected with you and your course, because I knew I needed that skill. And no, my team won't be trained. We won't all do your course because we don't all need it. Ultimately, down the track, it'd be awesome if we all could. But in the interim, we're all focusing on a different skill. Like, I've got someone who does ethical tech, so she can help with the safety of victims and all that sort of thing. I've got someone else who does a lot more of, like, the programs and understanding the men's behaviour analysis and those sort of programs, so we can get it from the other side to go, well, we've got our offenders, what sort of training are they getting? What are they, and how are they using this training to continue that abuse, continue the manipulation? So we're all actually bringing these skills together, and we're working really well because we've all got that common goal. But none of us are worried about competing with each other. It's not like, oh, I'm going to lose a client or I'm going to lose a customer.
Yeah.
Because we're working together, we're actually going to bring in more people than we would individually, and we will make change.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I know you're not at that stage yet, the psychology element in the training, but that covers that. It covers perpetrator psychology and victim psychology. So yeah. So wait till you get there.
it's a very interesting, yeah. But this is what I mean. Like, again, like, I will be covering it in the course, but I've got someone in depth doing that psychology part of it.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant.
Yeah.
So I can touch on it, and she can then be the go-to and be laser. And it's having these connections.
Yeah, exactly.
To be able to provide the support.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So what would you say to any professionals, mainly in the police, who are lacking skills? What would you say to them?
There's no shame in lacking skills. We can't know everything, but we do need to be open to getting the advice, collaborating and connecting with someone who does have the skills. Like, I know we can't have every police station in Australia with someone trained or specialised in domestic abuse, but let's at least have teams that are trained that can overlook and oversight, that actually have trauma-informed training, they understand psychology, that they're willing to learn, they're willing to understand these behaviours, so they can actually pick up something rather than taking it on face value. Like, we can't all be experts at everything. So let's have some dedicated experts at what's going on. But then increase the generalised training to our staff or to the staff, to the support, so they've got a better understanding of what to look for. Let them be aware that they are going to have trauma themselves. So they are going to see situations so differently because they've got trauma. And for all the police emergency response, you've all got trauma because of the nature of your work. And we need to accept that. That was my biggest wake-up call when I was diagnosed. Because, again, it was due to DV. I went and got diagnosed because I was about to threaten to have my kids taken off me. Went through all my history and it was like, no, you're like every other emergency surfer, first responder, veteran. You have post-traumatic stress disorder. It's just the depth and how it impacts you that varies.
Yeah.
And we're taught to mask it in the police. We're taught not to address it. We need to deal with that as well.
Yeah, that's not the answer. Because at the end of the day, if they are not looking after their own well-being, that impacts how they show up with not just victims, but it impacts how they show up on the job as a whole with the perpetrators, with colleagues. It impacts the role massively. So they have to look after their own well-being. And we can, yes, we know we've got perpetrators within the system. We have. But we also have, you know, these are human beings at the end of the day, you know, that they maybe have a role that carries a lot of responsibility, for other people, but they're human beings. And at the end of the day, if they are on capacity overload, they can react out of character and not favorably that impacts somebody else. And this is where the police force as a whole has to take responsibility for their own people and look after them, you know, because, you know, they could end up getting hurt because of their own emotional well-being. You know, we have a suicide rate as well within police forces as well. You know, nobody, you know, that's not talked about a lot at all, but there are, you know, in every emergency service, there are suicide rates, and that's because their emotional well-being is not taken care of. So it's a real big jigsaw puzzle, and I've had this conversation with forces here that it's a big jigsaw puzzle. It's not just the knowledge is really important, absolutely, it's a big part of it, but also we need to look at the emotional well-being of the staff of the emergency services and the victims as well.
But again, educating them that it is normal if you are working in a first responder job like this, where you are exposed to trauma of all sorts, whether or not it's car accidents, fires, whatever, you're going to have trauma.
Yeah.
Let's acknowledge it, deal with it. So there's no stigma around it. So we can get support when we're struggling. We can get help. So we can build a more resilient force who can actually respond more appropriately with that knowledge that others are going to have trauma. They're going to respond from trauma.
Yeah.
So we can actually make that change. And I think once we reduce the stigma, people will accept the help. Therefore, they will respond better. Therefore, we will get better results because everyone is working together for the greater good rather than, no, I can't do this because I've got to have I've got a blue uniform, I've got to be tough and masculine and macho. I can't have emotion because they're just suppressing it.
Yeah.
And we've got plenty of news articles where police have lost it because they haven't had the support, haven't had the control. And
yeah.
That's no good for anyone because then the police lose respect even more and it has massive flow-on effects.
Yeah, yeah, it is, yeah, yeah. And again, I've also addressed that with the government and they I got a response back and they did acknowledge my concerns, and they said they're going to address in the UK, they're going to address it in 2027. I'm like, okay. So in the meantime, it's just what on earth is going on? Oh, geez. But yeah, it is. It's a whole jigsaw puzzle. Well, thank you, Alison. It's been wonderful having you on.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for listening. And we'll see you on the next episode.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of this vital conversation. If you feel inspired to take action and support women, girls and children affected by abuse, please visit the show notes in Kate's bio on UK Health Radio. There, you can register your interest in becoming a certified trauma-informed expert, specialising in topics that address this ever-growing crisis. Together, we can shape a safer future for those who need it most. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and remember, you are never alone.